Coming up, religion in the first days of the new administration. And feeding tubes, why the families of Alzheimer's patients insist on providing them, even when doctors say there's no hope of recovery.
It's always out of guilt. And we're the only Western country that I know of and where it operates like that.
Plus, Father Damien, who devoted his life to the lepers on the Hawaiian island of Molokai.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Immediately after President Barack Obama took office this past week, he issued orders that drew high praise from human rights activists and many religious leaders. The president signed an order to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center within a year. He also ordered the review of military trials of terror suspects and banned the harsh interrogation techniques that many have called torture. At the same time, Obama angered many abortion opponents when he reversed the so-called Mexico City policy. It had banned federal funding for groups that provide information on abortions or perform them overseas. Obama's order will now allow federal funds to flow to those groups. The role religion will play in the administration remains to be seen. But in Washington this past week, faith was a major part of the inauguration festivities and the days that followed. Kim Lawton has our report.
So help you God.
So help me God.
President Barack Obama was known for his God talk on the campaign trail, and that focus on religion continued in the first days of his new administration. Obama began his inauguration day, as many presidents before him have, with a private prayer service at St. John's Episcopal Church across from the White House. Then, more prayer at the swearing-in ceremony. Megachurch pastor and best-selling author Rick Warren gave the invocation. And Reverend Joseph Lowry, the veteran civil rights leader, gave the benediction. Obama's inaugural address was sprinkled with several references to Scripture and to God.
This is the source of our confidence, the knowledge that God calls on us to shape an uncertain destiny.
The two men who prayed at the ceremony are both Protestants, but Obama specifically praised America's religious diversity.
For we know that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness. We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers.
Religious diversity was on full display Wednesday when the Obamas and the Bidens attended what was billed as a national prayer service at Washington's National Cathedral.
This is their first full day on the job, and the best way we can imagine to begin is by praying with them and for them.
Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, and Hindu leaders were among those who took part in the service, offering prayers and guidance from their faith traditions.
What you are entering now, Mr. President and Mr. Vice President, will tend to draw you away from your ethical center. But we, the nation that you serve, need you to hold the ground of your deepest values, of our deepest values.
Not everyone was happy about all the religion that was tied to the inauguration. A group of atheists launched an ultimately unsuccessful court battle to try and stop the official inaugural prayers. But as a recent poll for Religion and Ethics News Weekly found, the majority of all Americans say they believe that God has uniquely blessed this nation. And many expect that God should be acknowledged at big national events. Religious groups sponsored a host of unofficial events this week as well. Prominent black leaders celebrated at the African American Church inaugural ball. Many saw Obama's election as a direct result of the black church organizing first started by Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr.
There would be no point in trying to
really speak to the beauty and the strength and the meaning of Barack's inauguration without finding some way to speak to the strength and the beauty and the meaning of Black religion as it inspired the people who opened the way for Obama.
Faith-based activists at an interfaith peace service pledged to continue working toward King's full vision for America. Many here were optimistic about a positive relationship between Obama's administration and the religious community.
President Obama really is grounded in his own personal faith, and I think he values the religious voice. I think it is wise of him to bring in a broad spectrum of that religious voice.
There was also high optimism among American Muslims who sponsored their own inaugural gala. Many here praised Obama's stated goal to improve relations between Islam and the West.
To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect.
It's very clear to me that many people in the Muslim world overseas are so eager for a positive message from the United States. And I'm very hopeful that that we're going to have an opportunity to convey that positive message and to do some healing.
But there was also concern this week in some sectors of the faith community. Tens of thousands of abortion opponents came to Washington Thursday for the annual March for Life, which marks the anniversary of the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade decision. Obama released a statement reaffirming his support for a woman's right to choose, but he also urged new policies to reduce the number of abortions. Still, these activists are angered by administration plans to expand federal funding for abortion and for embryonic stem cell research.
There's certainly some contrast here and concerns over some very fundamental issues of the respect of human life. Of course, then we get into the issue of marriage and of the traditional family. A lot of issues that raise concerns with us.
Family Research Council President Tony Perkins does praise the way Obama has incorporated faith-based outreach into his politics. Perkins says religious conservatives are willing to work with Obama when they can.
We're not here to be adversaries of the president if he's doing the right thing. We want to encourage him and help him do the right thing, but we will, if forced to, take an adversarial role if he is moving the nation in the wrong direction, as it appears he is on the issue of life.
A spokesman for the new president says Obama is looking forward to working with, quote, a range of partners in the faith community. But keeping all those partners happy will be no easy task. I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
In the Middle East, the United Nations and humanitarian groups are working to get aid into Gaza. More than 1,000 Palestinians were killed in the conflict with Israel, many of them civilians, and close to $2 billion worth of damage has been reported. Relief groups charge that Israel has barred access to the region. Israel said it wants to ensure that Hamas, the militant group that controls Gaza, does not benefit from the rebuilding effort. We have a story today about an ethical dilemma in the care of patients with Alzheimer's disease. More than 5 million Americans have that terrible illness, which gets progressively worse and for which there is no cure. After a certain point, should an Alzheimer's patient be kept alive with a feeding tube? Many family members say, of course, they should do everything possible to prolong a loved one's life. But some doctors say inserting a feeding tube is inhumane because it can prolong a vegetative state for years. All those involved say they want what's best for the patient, but who's right and who should decide? Betty Rollin reports.
Dorothy Gregory, who is 85, has end-stage Alzheimer's and lives in a nursing home in North Carolina. She stopped eating 5 years ago, at which point a feeding tube was inserted into her abdomen. That was the decision of her nephew, Bobby Davis, whom she brought up.
Does she know who you are?
No, she don't know who I am. She don't know anyone. Mostly she's like a vegetable almost, you know. She can't talk, and she can't do anything for herself. But she's on that feeding tube. That's the only thing keeping her alive.
Dr. Doug Nelson oversees the care of many Alzheimer's patients and is greatly troubled by what he sees as the aggressive use of feeding tubes and other measures to keep end-stage Alzheimer's patients alive.
You go back to the Bible, do unto others as you would have done unto you. I would never want somebody to do this to me, because when you look at the patient, they're sitting there, they're crumpled, they develop bed sores, they get contractures, they can't move their arms or legs, the muscles just freeze up, and they're simply laying there existing, waiting for something else to happen that will finally kill them. In a typical patient with Alzheimer's, they gradually get worse and worse, and then at some point, they stop eating. One of two things happens at that point. Either one, we keep the person comfortable, we continue to try to offer them food or water or both, and they eventually just peacefully pass away. Or sometimes what happens is the families insist on a feeding tube, and we're forced to put a feeding tube in there, and then they'll lay there for months or years.
If you had to make the decision again, would you have the tube put in?
Yeah.
You would?
Sure.
Because just to keep her living.
That's right. If you believe in God, a miracle might happen. But I just don't think it's right to, you know, choose whether a person should live or die.
How you doing, girl?
Many family members decide on the feeding tube because they think the alternative is starvation. But Dr. Nelson says that's not how it is.
The patient will die, but they will die of dehydration, not starvation. What you think about it, that's how God designed most of us to die. We get some kind of disease, we stop eating and drinking. It's the lack of water that will kill us within a couple of weeks, not the lack of calories.
How painful is that?
It is not painful at all.
Why then do family members choose a feeding tube?
It's always out of guilt. And we're the only Western country that I know of and where it operates like that.
Guilt of what sort?
That they're not doing everything they could for their loved one.
Sharon Newell's mother, Barbara Kinley, has suffered a series of strokes as well as dementia. After the feeding tube was inserted, she got pneumonia, a common complication of the tube.
She was in intensive care for 28 days on a ventilator for 14. And at that point, when the doctors and nurses and even other family members were like, you know, you need to turn it off and let her go, et cetera, et cetera. And that is just not, wasn't an option. We are a religious family. Our, you know, my belief is in God and that we're all in His hands.
Sharon has also seen to it that her mother has what is called full code, which means that everything medically possible should be done to keep her alive.
She would never, ever give up on one of us, regardless. And there's just no way we could ever give up on her and not give her every benefit that she deserves.
Because her mother is on Medicaid, as most of these patients are, Sharon does not pay for these benefits.
The average cost of a semi-private room in a nursing home is more than $72,000 a year, plus the cost of whatever medical interventions are used. The insertion of a feeding tube is only a few thousand dollars, but the main cost is the result of the feeding tube, which can prolong a patient's life, sometimes for years.
Dr. Nelson is one of the few doctors who tries to convince families how bad a decision feeding tubes can be. But doctors are not paid to do that.
And so from a money issue, most doctors that do nursing home work find it hard to take the time out to do it for free and talk with the family. So if the family says, I want a feeding tube, many times it's a knee-jerk reaction, okay, fine, we'll do a feeding tube.
And not to comply with the family's wishes is to risk being sued.
If the family says, I want a feeding tube in, you have to put one in. All our malpractice insurance companies tell us if they do that, you put it in, because if you don't, patient dies, you go to court, you'll lose in court.
What bothers Dr. Nelson most of all about this situation is his conscience.
I question myself, am I sinning by continuing to have this feeding tube? When you look at the chart, the doctor's name that signs the order for the feeding tube is Doug Nelson. And I always wonder, what's going to happen when I get to heaven and I'm confronted by God? Well, why did you keep signing your name to that if you thought it was wrong?
Just listening to your chest this morning.
Nicole Lewis is a nurse who works with Dr. Nelson.
Once a tube feeding is put in, the decision's much, much harder for a family member. Say complications do arise, to make that decision to take it back out. And a lot of times that is what happens, whereas if the decision maybe had even been thought through a little more, they'd been educated a little more as to what complications could arise, they may not have made the decision to put the tube feeding in to begin with. We'll be back in a little while, okay?
One way to fix this situation is for Alzheimer's patients to have both a living will and a health care power of attorney, which protects you from treatment at the end of life you may not want.
Dolly, look at me. Wake up. This is Bobby talking to you. Wake up.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Betty Rollin in Gastonia, North Carolina.
The ethical arguments also surround removing a feeding tube once it's in. The Vatican, among others, says removal is immoral. For the past 50 years, many churches and health organizations have observed the last Sunday in January as the World Day of Leprosy. Hansen's disease, as it's also known, is now curable, but it still strikes 250,000 people each year. Remembering leprosy victims recalls the life of Father Damien, a Belgian priest who cared for the outcasts in a leprosy colony in Hawaii and who eventually died of leprosy himself. Father Damien is expected to be named a saint later this year, and Lucky Severson tells his story.
This place may look like a slice of heaven, but to many who lived here, it was hell on earth. This is Kalapapa, which was and still is a leper colony on the Hawaiian island of Molokai. It is an extremely isolated place, forgotten by the civilized world for over 100 years. That may soon change because of the honor about to be bestowed on a priest long ago who helped the diseased of Kalapapa when no one else would. His name was Father Damien de Vister, a missionary priest from Belgium. He is remembered by another Catholic priest, Father Clyde Guerrero.
It's the story, the classic story of heroic virtue versus the worst we can be as human beings.
Father Damien called the numerous cemeteries on Kalapapa Gardens of the Dead. Almost all of the 8,000 souls buried in these gardens were victims of Hansen's disease, also known as leprosy. Its victims were first exiled here beginning in 1866, forcefully separated from their loved ones, treated as criminals, literally thrown off the boat near this rocky beach.
The schooner would park out there and they just throw them over. And if they survived, well, then they lived here.
When Father Damien arrived in 1873, those thrown from the boat, the castaways, lived under the most primitive conditions without potable drinking water. In shacks they constructed out of sticks and dried leaves. Food was scarce. Doctors would occasionally leave medicine but refused to touch the patients. Survival was all that mattered, and the place became a lawless wildland. Father Damien would change all of that. Father Lane Akiona grew up in Molokai and grew up admiring Father Damien.
He was the builder, he was the coffin builder, he was the grave digger. He did the services, he anointed them, he was their nurse and doctor. He did practically everything for them.
And when Father Damien was 49, he died for them, a victim of leprosy. He had simply treated too many sores and infections. His grave is located next to a church he preached in. Most of those buried on Kalapapa died in the early 1940s before the new sulfone drugs were developed that controlled the infectious disease and stopped its contagion. Still, it wasn't until 1969, a quarter of a century later, that the law ordering forced exile was finally lifted. Dr. Walter Chang says victims of Hansen's disease have always been treated with callous disregard.
From the Bible and from in the historical accounts, leprosy was considered very ghastly disease. You know, the lepers were detested, they were stoned, they were even killed.
Today there are only about 20 patients living in Kalapapa, where there is now a hospital and care is always available for those still afflicted with the disease. They were sentenced here. Some don't need to stay any longer, but they do. Others stay because they can't leave the stigma behind. Meli Watanuki has been here since 1969 because it's her home.
Are you still sick?
No.
But you have to take medicine every day, right?
Yeah, that was way before, you know, when I went get sick. I got to take the medicine for cure.
But you don't have to take the medicine anymore?
No.
The place is still almost as inaccessible as it was in the 1800s. No one is allowed in without government permission. There are only two ways onto the peninsula, an up and down 8-minute flight over the world's tallest sea cliffs, which separate the colony from the outside world, or a steep mule train ride down from what is known as Topside. Audrey Toguchi, a retired school teacher, has made the journey from her home in Honolulu 5 times, always to pray at Father Damien's gravesite.
Oh, he's helped me a lot. He really has. And so how else can I look at him but as my hero?
See how vicious it looks? They look like all kinds of different criminals.
If Father Damien was Audrey's hero before, she's convinced he's become her lifesaver. After Dr. Walter Chang, a general surgeon, diagnosed her with a very rare kind of aggressive cancer of the fat tissues 10 years ago.
No, I told her you needed chemotherapy. Without chemotherapy, I said, the likelihood of you surviving a long time is extremely small.
How long did it give you to live?
Well, probably about 5 to 6 months.
Well, she told me very calmly, Doctor, I'm not going to accept chemotherapy. I'm going to Molokai to pray to Father Damien. And I replied, Mrs. Toguchi, prayers are very nice, but you still need chemotherapy. And she said, Doctor, I am going to pray only.
And so Audrey made one more trip to Father Damien's grave, and here's what she said.
Father Damien, I have all these problems, and I really need your help to intercede. And dear Lord, please, please help me.
Okay, this is Mrs. Taguchi's x-ray before she went to Molokai. This is cancer spread to her lungs.
But after she returned from Father Damien's graveside, the x-ray showed her cancer was receding. Eventually, it disappeared altogether.
And Dr. Chang said, what did you do? I said, I asked Father Damien for help.
I said to myself, this is a very remarkable event. It's never happened before in as far as I can detect from the history of medicine. So I said to myself, you know, Mrs. Taguchi, I said, this is so remarkable, you ought to report it to the people in your religion.
Mrs. Toguchi contacted the Vatican and sent along Dr. Chang's meticulously detailed record of her recovery, which was thoroughly investigated by church authorities, who eventually declared it a miracle. Now Father Damien is scheduled to become, officially, Saint Damien.
The true skeptic will call this a random coincidence. The true believer, the truly faithful, will call this a miracle. I think I'll have to straddle that line and call it a complete spontaneous or complete and permanent spontaneous regression of cancer.
The canonization process is not quick or easy. Father Damien was first officially venerated for his work on Kalapapa over 100 years ago. Then to become a saint, he needed to perform 2 miracle healings, authenticated by the best science of the times. The first, many years ago, was a French nun. The second, in 1999, was Audrey Toguchi. The news that Father Damien was going to become Saint Damien did not come as a surprise to the patients still living here. To them, he's always been a saint, one who would not recognize Kalapapa today. The place seems like an island paradise with well-groomed bungalows, a grocery store, and a gas station. It's a quiet place, but that may change after the Vatican formally canonizes Father Damien. Clarence and Ivy Kahalahaiwa have been here more than 50 years.
Is this a spiritual place here?
I think it's more than that. The man of the spirit is here. I guess because of our ancestors who died here way back.
To know that so many people went there feeling helpless, no sense of hope. And here comes this missionary from a foreign land and was willing to do everything for them. It is a spiritual place.
As long as there are patients here, the government will continue to restrict the number of visitors. But the patients are getting older. The youngest is almost 70. And when they're gone, only the gardens of the dead will speak of Kalapapa's dark, painful history. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Kalapapa, Hawaii.
On our calendar, on Monday, it's the New Year for the Chinese, as well as the Vietnamese and Koreans. Preparations are underway for the two-week festivities that will include prayers to ancestors and deities. This will be the Year of the Ox, which, according to tradition, portends a year of prosperity achieved through hard work and perseverance. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more on religion and politics on our One Nation page. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the Washington Performing Arts Society, Children of the Gospel Choir, at Wednesday's National Prayer Service.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
We are PBS.
Next time, they're sentenced to life in prison without parole for crimes, sometimes horrible crimes, committed when they were juveniles. Do these young criminals deserve a second chance, a chance for parole?
Why should these juveniles not get life in prison? Age cannot excuse what they have done.
I'm Bob Abernethy. Join us for the next Religion and Ethics News Weekly.